Right now at Honda, find your kind of value with a low finance rate offer on selected Civic hatch and sedan models. There's never been a better time to get into a Civic. So talk to your local dealer and let's help you into a Honda today. T's and C's apply. Ends August 31st. See website for details.
You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM. Hello, listeners. You're back with the Batuta Advocate News Hour on Desert Rock FM, recording live from Koala Studios in downtown Batuta. I'm Clancy Overall.
And my name is Errol Parker. We've just pulled back in from Rocky Beef Week. We've had a good time up there with the nation's proud primary producers. And judging by the luxury four-wheel drives lined up on the oval of Rockhampton High School, things are going just fine in the cattle game.
Yes, yes, indeed. As well as all the Arby Sellers shirts and the like. A lot of toys on display up there in Rockhampton. Things are looking good. We were happy to be up there and see that. But let's move on with the show.
Well, today we have a very special guest. We have a sitting federal MP and counter-terrorism expert, Dr. Anne Ali, who said she'll speak quite freely about some of her colleagues and political opponents in Canberra, as well as the comparatively different road she's taken into politics.
Yes, but first, there's been a few news stories around town that we'll need to get into. A ram raid on a prominent tobacconist outlet in the Flight Path District has been foiled after a failed attempt at pulling the ATM out of the store with a chain left behind a bull bar that was wedged in the facade of the arcade shopfront.
Yes, Bevan Hughes of West Batuta Hills was identified around 17 minutes later after police on the scene recognised the licence plate still attached to the hopper knocker that came off from a car registered to his name.
Poor old Bevan, we've always worried about him, and he's back in the shit. He's looking at doing another stint in the pen and might make it home for Christmas in 2020.
Yeah, just after the Tokyo Olympic Games. And we've got more breaking news coming out of the leafy exclusive enclave of Batuta Grove at the moment. It appears our humble outback town is hosting its first ever same-sex divorce as Linda and Beryl Hourigan hit the family courts today to divvy up their assets.
Yes, and out of his depth, 81-year-old magistrate Walter Carson has been given the daunting task of nutting out who is entitled to what in the recently separated couple's multi-million dollar catering business, as well as the three Subaru wagons, one Harley Davidson fat boy, and a 17-year-old German Shepherd bitch named Porsche.
And I've heard on the grapevine, Clancy, that Beryl has fired the first salvo across Linda's bow by burning their shared collection of Kookaburra hockey sticks.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good. That looks like it's going to get messy. All the best to the lawyers and the magistrate, of course.
The real winners in all this.
Yes, indeed. And that's it for local news, Errol. We've had a fair bit going on in the sports world this week. Justin Langer's got the top job as the Aussie cricket coach. Ponting is going to be heading up the commentary team for Channel 7, is it?
It is 7 this time around, yes.
And league players are still trying to sell coke on the side. But least surprisingly, Israel Folau still doesn't like the gays.
Yeah, he's still thumping the Bible, Clancy. And I guess we're starting to wish that we never asked this Mormon footballer from Logan what his opinion on homosexuality actually was. We actually wrote extensively about this week.
Yes, how did that go?
Folau apparently not okay with gay lifestyles, despite previously rocking the short back and sides, feathered blonde fringe.
Yes, the Wallaby star has once again indicated that he is not a supporter of gay lifestyles and culture, despite the fact that he rocked that dashing little blonde number for a whole season back in 2014.
Back in the golden age.
Yes, yes. They brought a premiership that year. Folau insists that his absolutely fabulous hairstyle, which saw him go all the way to the silverware, had actually only been styled by heterosexuals, a claim that even his cauliflower-eared teammates are sceptical of.
And one of Folau's teammates, a prominent country kid who's asked to remain anonymous for the time being, he told The Advocate that he reckons it's bullshit, and he said to us, "That salad has come straight out of Oxford Street. No way his barber was straight. Look at that precision."
Yes, I've got good reason to believe that quote either came from Curtly Beale or Paddy Ryan, but I won't specify because that's divisive and it's the last thing rugby union needs in this country is people picking on townies. Elsewhere around Australia, there's been a bit of chat about this year's budget. We wrote a story about that one with one man who has had enough with funding other people's lifestyles.
Yeah, that headline read, "The money needs to come from somewhere," says Liberal voter wearing tax-deductible RM William boots.
The man we spoke to, William Hugo Smith Willingtonly, a 55-year-old corporate silver fox who thinks that the concept of public housing is just a result of learned helplessness, says he's all for a fair go, but some people are just leeches. He said to our reporters, "Mate, it's all good and well to cry poor, but where's the money coming from? Riddle me that. Who's going to pay for these people to sit at home and do nothing because they have chosen to live that life?"
Well, that man who grew up in what he says is one of the rougher parts of the North Shore down in the United States of Sydney explained to one of our reporters that it's not hard to get a decent pair of boots on your feet and find a bit of work. You just need to part with 500 clams for some RMs and tell the ATO you need to impress your colleagues. He said he's gone and done the same with his daughter's Volkswagen Golfs and their two-bedroom units.
Yes, it is just that easy, isn't it, Errol? And I would say that our large L Liberal friend, what was his name again? William Hugo Smith Willingtonly would be very pleased with the recently announced cuts to the ABC.
Yeah, I would say so too, comrade. We did write a story on those cuts, actually. The line on that story was, "Cuts to ABC funding unlikely to make Q&A any worse."
We spoke to the head of the ABC, Michelle Guthrie, after the news filtered through that the national broadcaster was getting a bit of a caning. And she assured us that Q&A will still be the same petri dish of party line towing and unbalanced debate it has always been. She said, "It won't be easy, but we are committed to delivering the Monday evening sense of dread you experience from watching a discussion on climate change between a professor of particle science and a man who has never won a game of noughts and crosses."
And she also said that the hobbyist people who adore the smooth-talking Jones needn't worry that his head's going on the chopping block because no one who wears a suit to work down at the ABC is going to get a pay cut.
Yes, of course, the public servants can't possibly afford to take home any less with them, which brings me to our next guest, an academic type, in fact, a doctor, one so learned that she could definitely have made more money outside Canberra as a consultant or even a professor, but she's hesitantly made a run at politics, and she's here today to talk about it.
And she's just walked through the door. Here she is, Dr. Anne Ali. Let's get into it.
Well, Ali Bombay.
Ali, Ali, Ali.
Killam Ali. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
No, it's great to have you here. Obviously, Perthinian.
Yeah. Technically. Is that what you call them? Perthinians?
Oh, Perthinese.
Perthinese.
Yeah. Perthiacs.
Perthiacs.
Perthinites.
Perthinites. I like that one. Yeah, that works.
But yes, Anne Ali, MP.
That's me.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to have, again, a sitting member of parliament.
I thought you were going to say sitting duck.
Sitting duck.
Okay. Great to have a sitting duck here.
Well, yeah, I guess you are. You are in a degree, you know, to a degree on this podcast. But like I said, it's great to have a member of parliament with a background and a career.
That's not in politics.
That's not in politics.
Yeah, we need more of us.
Mind you, a lot of people would say that your background is political, according to, you know, maybe the Murdoch press.
Yeah, people like to politicise what I used to do, but I was very apolitical. Actually, I had no interest in politics, no. And so coming into politics, it's all been kind of new, and I'm like, what's that and what's that and what does that mean and what are you doing here and why are we doing this? So, yeah, completely an outsider, really.
Counterterrorism was where you ended up prior to politics.
Mm.
Can you just give us a quick rundown of how you got there?
Okay. How do
not
I make
the cops.
This quick? No. Okay, so I kind of by accident, really.
So as the story goes, you were up in Bali on a bit of a break, as every good Perthanite does from time to time.
With the energy drinks and braided hair.
Getting it
you're
on
in the
Kuta.
Same time zone, you know, so yeah. It's all very, very relative, no jet lag, no nothing. And you got the call asking if you'd like to be a politician.
It goes a little bit back further than that because that was 2015.
Yep.
And 2015 was probably my biggest year in terms of my academic and what I like to call – didn't really like to call myself an academic. I like to call myself a pracademic, so academic and practitioner in the kind of CVE counter-radicalisation space. So it was this, the peak of my career. I got invited to the White House in February, nearly froze my fingers off over there. Back at the White House in June with a group of students. Then I got this invitation to attend the Club de Madrid which is not a disco, calm down.
Sounds pretty fun.
It is. It does sound fun, but it wasn't. and to then speak at the Club de Madrid with the UN Secretary General, and then from there going on to UN talks in Vienna and participating in UN talks in Vienna. Had really high hopes for this, but within half a day became really disillusioned with the whole process, because here were all of these people who were either in power or had once been in power, and to me they had squandered. They had squandered all of that power, and instead here they were put together in a room and there was finger-pointing and blaming and yelling, and no one could come to any kind of consensus on how we deal with terrorism and radicalisation. So when it was my turn to stand up and speak at the end of this 2 days, I told them so. I don't think they'll have me back. And then about 3 weeks later, I went to Vienna for UN talks, walked out of there and just shook my head and said, you know, nothing's going to change. I'm going to come home to Australia and nothing's going to change because there's just no political will. And I said to my husband at the time, I said, I'm done. I'm going to find something else to do. I'm done with this. I'm done with all the talk fests. I'm done with all the policy discussions and all the work that's being done, and nothing ever changes. He just looked at me and said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. And then coming back, lying on the beach in Bali, there's that phone call.
Yep. Well, as fate would have it, in February of 2015, another very special and rare event happened in Australia that was spearheaded by a little-known Western Australian lower house member called Luke Simpkins.
I know him.
I know him. The electorate of Cowan.
Yeah.
And he put a spill motion against...
He had his 15 minutes.
He put the first spill motion against the then Prime Minister Tony Abbott, which resulted in Tony Abbott winning 61-39. And a little bit more about Luke Simpkins, you know, as we all know, he did share the parliamentary lunch table with, you know, the likes of Corey Bernardi, Hasty, Abetz, you know, all the most charming members of the lower house.
Because he was charming too.
He was. It's something that could only happen if it happened in real life, you know. You wouldn't believe that it could happen. But as the politics of WA has told us, you know, it's a very strange place politically. And he was an outspoken conservative, you know, he was against
halal.
He wanted to ban the burqa. He spoke out in support of sleep deprivation as a torture technique,
because that always works
for terrorism suspects. And then he went to the election up against
me.
You and he lost.
I know, so weird.
So can you talk us through that day in July 2016 where Luke had to eat his own shoes and...
and his hat.
And his hat.
With a bit of salt on it, like Laurel and Hardy.
and he had to hand the keys over to his blue ribbon electorate to... A Muslim woman.
Yeah. You know, it was really weird because you could not get a more chalk and cheese opponent in the election. Yeah. This tall white ex-military bloke and some short brown woman with four university degrees. And I remember sitting there and I had no idea what an election entailed. And in fact, when I first got that phone call in Bali, and then I rang my son and I said, WA Labor's calling me. What do you think they want? And he goes, oh, Mum, maybe they want you to run in the next election. This is me. There's an election? So I had absolutely no idea, but it was such a stark contrast between the two of us. And a lot of people predicted that I wouldn't win. They said it'd be close, but it would ultimately fall to Luke, because WA does tend to be quite a blue state, quite conservative. I don't know. I haven't done a complete analysis of what it was. I think that kind of that stark difference worked in my favour, because there was this very obvious choice in terms of candidates, and
it wasn't, you know,
it
wasn't Shortbag and Size number one, but Shortbag and Size number
exactly.
two.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't like he was up against Kim Beazley.
Exactly. You know? Or anyone else. So, it was very, very very interesting of how it all panned out. But in the end, did win, but by a very small margin.
Yeah.
I think
a win's
that
a, win,
a win's a win. Yeah, that's
what's
right.
The, what's the demographics that. Like of your electorate?
It's really diverse because, like, some suburbs have really high multicultural communities in them, and some suburbs are lower socioeconomic. The biggest number of immigrants is from the UK.
Right.
Got quite a few white South African, but also
as does all of WA.
Yeah.
I'm pecking for Perth, mate.
But I do have in some suburbs I've got 10% Muslim population.
Right. Yeah.
Largest language spoken is Vietnamese. So some suburbs are really, really diverse in terms of cultural and linguistic diversity, and others aren't. So it's a real mix, really.
Just going back to you know, how you ended up in the multicultural kind of arena. Affairs, that kind of stuff.
Because I'm brown.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that, but also there's the angle that there's the idea that, you know, and we hear, particularly with Perth, there's an artist that talks a lot, Abdul Abdullah.
Yeah, I know him. He's a good guy.
He says, and he tells this story that growing up, he had older brothers, and his brother's upbringing was a lot different to his because they were pre 9/11, but he was a kid during 9/11, and you've got sons.
Yeah.
What was the perception of Muslims in Perth before 9/11? What was it? It was a bit eccentric. You know, you hear people say it was almost like Hare Krishna. No one knew anything about these people. And then all of a sudden, overnight, politicised.
I've actually written about this. I've actually written a few articles about, like, just tracing the trajectory of the consciousness about Muslims in the Australian political sphere and public sphere and media sphere. And it really, I guess, it really started with the first Gulf War. And if you went even further back than that, the Iranian Revolution as well, but the very, very narrow stereotypes with the Iranian Revolution, and then came the first Gulf War. So, yeah, there wasn't this real cognizance of what Muslims do or who they are.
Bit of an eccentricity more than anything.
Yeah, it was. And and then comes 9/11, and people often talk about how 9/11 changed the world. I think it was more the response to 9/11 that changed, at least changed my world, in terms of that suddenly it was like we were statues in a room that came to life, and suddenly people noticed us and noticed what Muslims were and who they were, and had this enormous amount of attention, but not good attention. It was negative attention. So, yeah, it certainly changed the mood in Perth, and where I think perhaps – and it's had an impact on first and second generation Australian Muslims too, because it became the way for them to identify. Whereas, like, my generation, we tended to identify more with our ethnic background, Egyptian or Lebanese or whatever. But the first and second generations tended to identify more than now with Muslims, because that's how they were grouped. Yeah, they were identified by their religion, not so much by their ethnicity or their cultural heritage.
Well, you hear Waleed refer to himself as Mediterranean, you know, as you know, and as Egyptian, like, technically, yes. It's not what comes to mind for everyone when they think Mediterranean. They think pasta and the like, but Egypt is not the same as so many of these other countries that people would associate in their minds to Muslim, you know, communities.
Yeah, because it's got that long history, and, you know, it's in Africa, but it's also part of the Middle East and also part of, like, the Arab world. So, you know, rich DNA to choose from, whether you're Egyptian, Mediterranean, African, Middle Eastern, Arab. It's all there.
Yeah. And do you find you said before with the Muslims in your electorate, are you do you lock them in as a vote, or there's criticisms coming from your own community at times?
Oh, yeah, I get criticisms from everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like sitting duck.
Yeah.
No, there are criticisms from within my own community because it's a diverse community. Yeah. It's not a monolith, you know, not everyone agrees. It's like any kind of community. So I have supporters, but I also have detractors. It's just like anything else, really.
Do you ever get the, you know, from Egyptian community, she doesn't speak for us?
Not so much from the Egyptian community. They're more like, oh, we're so proud of you, you know. But from certain segments of Muslim communities, definitely. But I always say, well, I've never claimed to speak for you. I'm not in Parliament as the member for Muslims. Yeah, would the member for Muslims please stop interjecting? That's not my role there. My role is as the representing Cowan, representing an electorate within WA, and ensuring that their best interests are presented in Parliament.
So where does that place you inside the ALP? You know, because it's a union. I mean, it's a party that's quite factionalized.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your Shortens and all the other union heavies, you know, on one sort of lunch table. You've got Albo and Tanya and all the other guys who like to party a bit on one lunch table.
Mm. You're the no voters from Victoria.
Mm. Yeah.
You got a diverse community.
That's right.
So where would you kind of sit in the Labor Party?
Because I kind of come through an unorthodox path
yep.
politics, I guess. And there are a few of us like that, you know, the ones who've kind of had the tap on the shoulder, who've done something else before and then come into politics, who aren't, I guess, career politicians. So it is an unorthodox path, and so a lot of what I've been doing in my first 2 years is in terms of that is really learning about the party machinations and how it works, and I guess finding my place. Plug for the book. Finding my place within that structure and how that works, and what are the pathways to achieving things and making the kind of change that I want to see as well. I guess when you do have such a diverse grouping like that, you gravitate towards the people who share your values, and you form friendships, but you form friendships over the divide as well. Like, I count Andrew Broad as a good friend in Parliament. We don't agree on our politics. Our politics are different, but we're mates. Hmm. And some
more
of
them.
Yeah.
I mean, did more agreement on some parts of politics with Warren. But certainly there are people you don't have to agree with their politics, but you can still form friendships and find connections.
Yeah, because earlier this year we saw that Albo, he was up in the top end with Bob Catter, and they were hanging out, you know.
Did they have a lucid conversation? I've never had a lucid conversation with Bob Catter.
Well, we spoke to Glenn Drury, the preference whisperer, a few weeks ago, and he said that Bob Catter is the only person he's ever met who can interrupt himself.
Bob Catter come up to me one day and goes, "Oh, you've got to hear about what they're trying to do in Queensland with the Aboriginal housing." And I said, oh, thanks, but I'm not from Queensland. He goes, "Yeah, but you're Aboriginal."
Holy shit. That's we also
I think you mean Linda.
He also brought up ethanol during his Anzac Day address.
He didn't bring up anyone being eaten by crocodiles, did he?
No, I don't know. Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, we always get to, every guest we have, we end up talking about Bob because he is one of the life-wise, one of the few characters down there.
Oh, he certainly brings brings something different to Parliament.
But there's lots of people down, you know, in the more cosmopolitan parts of Australia that kind of think he's a bit eccentric. But, you know, if any of these people from the Big Smoke ever went up to the towers, up to Curry, up to Julia Creek, they'll find that Bob
was normal.
Representative.
Is a great and honest and true representative of his electorate, which is why he won 80% of the vote last time.
I think, you know, we need more diversity in Parliament, whether it's diversities of, rural regional representation.
He's Arabic too.
Yeah, he is. In Arabic, we call him Qatar.
Yeah. There's an H in there.
Yeah.
A couple more A's. Yeah. Now, you're obviously have a level of expertise, and that may have been what piqued the attention of the Labor Party early days. You can offer legitimate advice on legitimate issues and really real concerns. What's your take on how we have been handling young, at-risk kids with crazy ideas over the last few years?
I don't think we've been doing it very well. I've always said that our response has been very heavily on the side of legislative change and developing a legislative framework. Do you know Australia has the most legislation around terrorism and acts related to terrorism than any Western country?
Right. Really?
We have the most. We have the broadest suite of legislation on terrorism and relating to terrorism than any other Western country, despite the fact that, touch wood, we haven't experienced a mass casualty attack on our soil. So there's something to be said about that, that predominantly our response has been a hard response, a hard kind of legislative response, and we've really neglected the stuff that that affects social change, affects cultural change, that really deals with the mobilisation and the motivations and the grassroots issues. We don't have an equally strong civil society sector to deal with this, and we haven't had that kind of attention. So I think we need to start balancing out now the soft and hard. We should have started a while ago, but I don't see it happening with this government, to be honest.
Can you explain, with your education and your expertise, where's the disconnect between a kid from a family that has fled these kind of ideologies? How in a generation does a kid then cling to that as his thing?
Okay, so first of all, it's not always
second
generation who have come from those backgrounds. So the question is then, how is this narrative, the ISIS or Al-Qaeda inspired narrative, how and why is it so influential on young people who have no connection to it?
Yeah.
You know, you've got Jake Bilardi, young kid from the burbs of Melbourne, who went over and fought with ISIS. How are they connecting to that? But more recently, there's been some really interesting studies. There was a book by a bloke called Olivia Roy called Jihad and Death. I don't recommend you read that on an aeroplane. but he looks very much into this phenomenon with second generation, and he talks about a culture of violence, and it's the culture of violence that's attracting them. I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the full picture. I think a lot of it has to do also with, yes, there's an attraction to violence, there's an attraction to fighting, there's this kind of victim identity that appeals to a lot of people. And in fact, if you look at marketing studies, the victim frame is one of the most powerful frames for mobilising action in people. Everyone wants to be a victim because they feel like they're missing out if they're not a victim, they're missing out on something that, that victims get.
Just look at Twitter.
Victim identity, this culture of violence and the attraction of violence, of wanting to be a soldier and to fight for something that means something.
Yeah.
Plus, one of the studies that I was doing was looking at the histories of violent actors, violent jihadist actors specifically, and looking at if there was a history of aggression. And around one third have a history of aggressive behaviours or violent behaviours. So I came up with a theory called the rapid escalation of violence to explain why they become attracted to that next stage of violence, and why ISIS appeals, or the narrative of ISIS appeals to them in that kind of context.
Yeah, because what happened with Jake Bilardi and a few others is ISIS recruited them online.
Yeah,
that's been something new that all these, you know, broad-reaching counterterrorism bodies, the government bodies, have had to attack. Has it always sort of been that way? Has there been a different way to recruit the young people? Like, we look back to how David Hicks, how he found his way from Adelaide to Kabul. You know, he obviously didn't get that information online.
So two things. The first thing I want to say is, even if we go way back to early terrorist movements, so the anarchist movement, the anarchist movement really took off with the introduction of the printing press, because they were then able to distribute their propaganda worldwide and influence people through the printing press. So communication, being able to communicate with potential recruits, with groups of people who are going to be influenced by your narrative, has always been a part of terrorism. So it kind of makes sense that as technology progresses and we find new ways of communicating, so too would the way that terrorists recruit people utilise those kinds of platforms as well. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we often hear these kind of unsubstantiated theories about online radicalisation. And every time there's a terrorist attack, you have some talking head come out and go, yeah, he was rapidly radicalized online or self-radicalized online. There's actually no consistent evidence to prove that. In most of the cases, I think there's just one case of somebody who was completely online.
Yep.
Most of them also involve some kind of social network offline as well. That's the same thing. And one more thing with that as well, if you look at Jake's case, he put it out there. From a very young age, he was fascinated with violent movements.
He was a
long-haired
kid.
The baby face, long-haired kid. From a young age, he was fascinated with violent movements, fascinated with violent movements. And in his own head, he justified it by saying these were brave men fighting for their rights. So he had to put himself out there. Right? It's not and he made an effort to contact someone who could help him, who could recruit him. It's not like there's all these young Muslim men sitting around in front of a computer with their mouths open, just waiting to be reeled in. There is a level of self-motivation.
Well, there is one talking head that always comes out when these things happen, and she's also in Canberra. Whenever there is a
the minute you said she, I went, I don't know who you're talking about.
A very, you know, is if there's violence and Islam involved, on the popular and controversial breakfast television show Sunrise, they often have renowned terrorism and Islam expert Pauline Hanson on to make sense of it all. And to reassure the public that, you know, that, that there are people in Canberra who are working to
wear burqas in Parliament.
Yeah. Have you ever had any discussions with Pauline about, you know, your tertiary background in terrorism? And
I had lunch with Pauline.
Yeah.
So I invited her out for lunch when I first got elected and, you know, sat down and said to her, you know, part of this really is that we're going to disagree on a lot. Let's make that clear.
Even probably on everything. Lunch.
Yeah, actually, we both had salad. and I just wanted to say to her, you know, I just want to make sure that that disagreement is done in a civil manner.
Yeah.
And that it's respectful. But I did talk to her. I talked to her about my research and my studies, and she said to me, she said, "Oh, I think you're wrong." I said, "Okay, why do you think I'm wrong?" She goes, "Because on my Facebook page, people are saying this, this, and this." And so I said to her, "You do know Facebook is not a valid source of data. It's not a valid form of research."
You wouldn't be able to quote it in an academic paper.
Yeah. I mean, if some of my students had done that, I would probably fail them. But, yeah. So you know, it just shows that where people, you know, There's choice involved in here. You know, you have a choice as a leader, as somebody who is in Parliament. Yeah. You can choose to be populist and gather your information and develop your policies based on your Facebook posts and what's on there.
Knee jerks and
Or you can do your due diligence and and research the facts.
Because there's another person who is opposite you in the lower house, who's also quite anti-halal and whatnot, who just happened to travel to Malaysia to have
halal surgery,
a lap band, where in as he was recovering in hospital, he was enjoying his
halal water,
his halal lamb cutlets.
I wanted to ask him if the doctor said Allahu Akbar before he cut him.
Have you?
Then it would be really halal.
So have you taken him to lunch, had a steak with George?
No, I haven't had a steak with George, but I do talk to George and, you know, again, one of those people that I disagree with on a whole lot of stuff. But I have a bit of fun with George, you know.
The fact that you are the first Muslim woman in Parliament, do you find a few cultural gaffes being made, you know, to...
Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the things that
A few. Well, I think one of the big things is there's really not, like, this report that came out from the Human Rights Commission recently that looked at the representation of people from non-Anglo, non-European backgrounds in in positions of leadership and including in Parliament. So the Australian population is around 21% of people who come from a non-Anglo background. In other words, visibly different ethnic minorities, whatever label you want to give to it, really. And in Parliament, in all of Parliament, all the backbenchers, it's only 4%. So I'm one of that 4%, which doesn't make us very many. On the front bench of the government, 0%.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So we're making policies for 21% of the population without any real informed debate or discussion or input on how those policies might impact on that 21%. So yeah, there have been gaps, and it's across both parties. Let me say,
yeah.
There have been gaps. So like, we'll put out a statement on women, for example, and there's absolutely nothing on women with disabilities or women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds or women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds who have disabilities. You know, there are those things. There was that famous one with Broadie where this was in the context of the 18 C debate, and I'd just given an example of when I was 10 years old and there used to be this girl at school, my sworn enemy, made me her sworn enemy, who would just consistently sneer at me and spit in my face about being a Muslim. And Broadie came up, he goes, "When I was at school, I used to get wedgies too, Anne." And I said, "Yeah, but you know what, Broadie, you didn't get them because of the colour of your skin. And you didn't get them because of who you are, mate."
Because you're a dork.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this real lack of understanding, and really, when we talk about like multiculturalism and cultural diversity, it's always about migrants and refugees.
Mm, yeah.
It's not really about the character of Australia.
Yeah. Or the seven generations in Chinatown. You know.
Absolutely.
But I'm talking also about socially. Do you find that there's these stale male pale ministers that treat you like you're from Mars?
Exotic.
Yeah.
Like an iguana.
Yeah.
You're so exotic. Yeah, like an iguana or a giant penis-shaped flower. A focus on your appearance and what you wear and, you know, your curly hair and all of that kind of stuff. I'm kind of used to it, really, but it is quite. I think the other one is I often get mistaken for Linda Burney, and she often gets mistaken for me because, like, we're the two brown women, so obviously we must be the same person. Plus, people have never seen us in the same room together, so. I can't tell you how many people said, "I love that photo of you and Warren Edge." And I'm like, "No, that's Linda."
So you've got a book out.
Yeah.
Through HarperCollins. How was that to finally sit down and write something that wasn't academic, you know, like
it was hard.
A book that wasn't about, you know,
terrorism
and special forces and Tom Clancy and stuff like that.
Did you ever use your son as a reference for a lot of the stories you were saying in there?
Yeah, that played a big role in it. My boys play a big role in the book. Oh, look, when they rang me, when the publisher rang me and goes, "Oh, we want you to write a book," I'm like, "Great. I've got a book on terrorism ready to go, 100,000 words, 2 weeks. And they were like, "Nah, we want you to write a book about you." And I'm like, "Nah, and I write books about me." I said, "What am I going to write about? That I sit around eating Doritos and watching trash TV every night? Nah." But, you know, eventually I said, "Yep," and started writing it. And it's actually really confronting. You kind of open up a lot of wounds of your background and how you got to where you are as well. And just choosing what goes in the book and what do I want to keep for myself was a big one as well. But I remember I'd never written anything that wasn't technical before. And I consider myself a good technical writer. I can write a good academic piece. So starting this, I'm sitting there and I wrote it all on planes, 29 chapters on 29 flights, and the whole time I'm writing it, I'm going, "This is crap. Nobody's going to want to read this." But, of course, I was comparing myself to Shakespeare. So, it was hard because I didn't have that confidence in writing something that wasn't about terrorism and that wasn't technical, but also because it was confronting. It's confronting to look back on your life and where you've come from and put all of that out there.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your kids. What's going on there? You got boys too?
I've got two boys. I've got Adam, who's with me here today, and Kareem, who lives in Melbourne.
Cool.
Yeah, they were in their
trendy
in their 20s. Cool, I'm waiting for grandkids, but apparently I'm not getting any anytime soon. So that's
what is it in Egyptian? It's not obviously baba.
What's grandma?
Yeah,
teta.
Teta.
Like batuta.
Yeah, right.
I've got a confession to make. I always thought batuta came from the Arabic word the patata, which means potato, but apparently it's not. It's batuta.
Yeah, yeah.
And it means something completely different.
Water hole, I think.
Yeah, I think.
Is it?
It comes from the mythical language, which is the clan in Batuta.
Channel country, Western Queensland.
It's It loosely translates to waterhole, and there is a big, nice waterhole just out the front of the pub.
And it's called Batuta, the Batuta waterhole.
It's called the Tita waterhole.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
What was the word you said though?
Batata.
Do you ever say that to Peter Dutton?
Don't give me ideas. Oh, that's a good one.
Tell us a little bit about Peter Dutton. Is he hard to work with?
He has got this like inimitable and unenviable capacity to make everything that comes out of his mouth racist. Pretty much.
Well, he's a highway cop.
License and registration, please.
Yeah, you know, we are.
I don't know. Look, obviously we don't agree on pretty much everything. I don't have much to do with him, to be honest, so I can't make a judgment on his character. I can only judge by what he says and in the context of the things that he says. And
does he say shit about you? Does he?
I don't know. If he is, I'm not paying attention, so keep going, mate.
Well, we're just wondering because obviously you are – if Labor, you know, wins the next election, you could be looking good for his job with your expertise anyway.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of security and that kind of stuff. So you are an authority on a lot of the shit he's talking about. Mm. Does he ever dismiss you in that regard or you don't engage?
Yeah, see, he's more like front bench. And so in Parliament, the front bench kind of tends to tic-tac with each other and us back benchers just –
just kind of hang out.
So is it, I really haven't had much to do with him, to be honest.
Well, he certainly didn't place his hand on a Quran when he took up his job, did he?
No, I think he saw mine and ran away. No, he didn't, but I did.
You did?
That was a hard decision.
Yeah?
It was a tough decision for me. It was something I grappled with.
Had anyone done that before? You mean the first Muslim woman had...
Yeah. No, Ed Husic did it. Ed Husic did his father's one. And in actual fact, I had originally planned not to.
Right.
Yeah. I had originally planned to take... A pledge and not an oath on a religious text.
Gillard style.
Yeah. Yeah, because I do believe in the separation of religion and politics.
So we're talking about, you know, there's things like that that you... you know, you afforded the opportunity in Australia to be able to do that on the Quran and stuff like that. And but then again, you do get people like Beteta Dutton.
Batata
Dutton, who, you know, are quick to ostracize those things outside of Canberra. Mm. And one particular one was the when he started teeing off on, like, second, third generation Lebanese people. That was well before your time those decisions were being made. So, you know... And it's particularly coming from Brisbane where you've got, you know, iconic Lebanese Australians. Yeah. You've got Stefan Akery, you know, Napoleon Hair Products. It's the pride of Brisbane is a second generation Lebanese man. You've got, you've got plenty of...
And wasn't Crazy John
Crazy
from there
John,
as well? Yeah. Crazy John Ilhan, yeah.
You've got a lot of people. Hazem El Mazri. We've got, you know...
He is, the highest point scorer ever in the NRL has never had a beer at the end of a game.
And he played during Ramadan on Sunday afternoons.
Yeah.
In fucking North Queensland.
Yeah.
And they used to ask him too at the end of the game, it's like, how is that? He says, oh, it's all right, but I'm a bit hungry. Yeah. I'm starving.
Wait for sundown. but do you find that kind of thing will, that kind of shit, do you find has an effect on young kids?
Absolutely, 100% has an effect on young kids because the privilege of having a platform. Right, privilege of having a platform, even if it is 2GB, right, and being able to use that to put out
ideas. Randall Live.
And being able to use that to put out ideas. And I don't know if he does it consciously or not, or if he recognises this immense privilege and how that affects and can affect society and social change and cultural change and how we define ourselves as Australian, or whether he's just doing it because it's politically expedient.
Yeah.
I think that it's a bit of both. I think that it is for him politically expedient, but I also think he holds deep-seated views on these things that fuel that kind of rhetoric as well. And it does have a huge impact. It has a huge impact. When I was doing my research for my PhD, I did some interviews. I did 180 interviews actually, but I did some focus groups as well with young Muslims. And I had a group of young Muslim blokes in there, and you know they were bro types. You know they were like masculine and
shaved legs.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, bro, alpha.
Yeah, alpha, and they broke down talking about how before 9/11 they really felt Australian and they knew where their place was and they knew who they were, and then suddenly all of that was being questioned. Mm-hmm. All of that was being questioned, and they were put in this position where they didn't know who they were supposed to be. People were telling them, "You're not Australian. You're not Australian. You're un-Australian," and they broke down in tears talking about this. And it has a huge impact for that generation who were either young or born after 9/11 as well, because they were kind of brought into this post 9/11 world where the us and them rhetoric and the political discourse on division has really been used as dog whistling, and the politics of race has really become entrenched in how we talk about these issues in Australia.
Because you look at different migrant waves in Australia, you look at Sunnybank in Brisbane with the Vietnamese community there, and you look at Cabramatta in Sydney, and then you just look at the Vietnamese where they were vilified and front page news, and you know, admittedly there were some issues in their community. You know, sitting member of New South Wales was killed in all that kind of, you know, and that looked like the type of stuff that you could never get past. And the, you know, the Arabic and Muslim community would almost, particularly the Lebanese, had almost had their decade. You know, they'd almost had their, you know, the WOG decade where they kind of get picked on. And then 9/11 happened almost at the point where you were saying these kids felt like they were Australian. Do you feel like if those towers hadn't gone down, we'd have a different narrative?
And there's an important point there, because you said, you know, it's things that you get past, but how do you get past it? You get past it because another group comes up, right? You're replaced.
Yeah. Is that what you reckon happens?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. You're replaced by tomorrow's demons, right? Australia has this history of, and in a way we've kind of come to accept it and say, oh, you know, that's just Aussies. You know, every migrant, we give them a bit of shtick and then, you know, it passes.
So it's not that we get used to them, it's because they get replaced.
Totally. Right. And so, my constant argument is why do we keep putting up with it? Why do we say it's okay? Oh, next, it's just something that we do to waves of immigrants who come here. Shouldn't we be questioning why we do this? Why are we doing this to people?
Do you think that it was made that much harder and that much more grueling for, you know, the Arabic kind of communities because of 9/11 as well?
Was 9/11 really, really. Post 9/11, you had this conflation, right? Remember the Tampa incident? Mm. Remember the children overboard? Those people who throw their children overboard when I want them in this country. It all turned out to be total bullshit. Mm. Nobody ever got really pulled up and hauled over the coals for all that bullshit.
Yeah.
And it really didn't get out there to the community that this was bullshit, and there wasn't this outrage that they were lied to about children overboard. So there was that. There became the conflation of the asylum seekers with criminal activity and terrorism, and it was politically on purpose. Mm-hmm. In 2001, John Howard rode to victory on a wave of fear. You know, it brought the election home for him to be able to say, we decide who comes into Australia and the circumstances under which they come here, by pointing the finger at and demonising and conflating all of those issues together.
Yeah. Do you find, in terms of finding place, do you find, I mean, you've got, you know, born in Cairo, back and forth to Cairo, you kind of ended up in, as we discussed, all these different areas and led you to counterterrorism and then eventually politics. Have you found yourself getting emotionally invested in shit you never thought you would have even cared about in politics now? You can call in to vote on sugar taxes and stuff like that.
Like little changes to legislative things. But the good thing about parliamentary life is that you can continue to pursue the things that you are passionate about and that you're interested in. And in fact, when I first had that first kind of meeting about whether or not I would run for Cowan, I remember saying, why would I do this? I've got a great job. I've got a high-level career. And the response was, because this is a different way for you to continue doing what you're doing. And I said, can you guarantee me that I can continue doing my work? And they said, yes, but it'll just be from a different perspective. So there is that opportunity to do that. So I do that through being on the Law Enforcement Committee, on the Committee for Joint Standing Committee for Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade. I tend to, like, there's some people in Parliament who'll speak on anything, anything they'll get up and speak on it. I tend to try and only speak about the things that I'm passionate about, that have relevance to my electorate or that I know something about. So anything on cybersecurity, security, counterterrorism, I'll stand up and speak on, because I think that I can make a valued and informed contribution to the debate. Anything to do with, you know, I was a single mum. I've lived on welfare. I know what it's like. It's bloody hard. So anything to do with that, I'll stand up and speak, plus anything that can fight this kind of demonisation of people who are on welfare as lazy shits, who are on the dole. That stuff is important to me. I'm passionate about that stuff.
Do you get on well with Jackie?
I do.
Yeah.
Jackie and I get on very well. I've got a lot of respect for Jackie. Yeah. She says some stuff, but, you know, I'll confront her.
She's changed the tune on a few things as well in times. Mm-hmm. Have you kind of... Yeah.
I think I give credit to Jackie for that.
Yeah.
And I think she deserves credit for that. I've certainly had discussions with her, but I give credit to Jackie. She's smart.
Mm.
She's smart and she's passionate. And I was sad to see her go. But, she's good. Yeah. We get on well. We joke a lot too.
I think everyone in Australia says that about Jackie.
Yeah.
Everyone says it. And then obviously everyone also then prefaces it with, well, there's a few things.
Yeah. Yeah. You can forgive her because it doesn't come from a place of malice.
Yeah.
Do you know?
I think everyone has an auntie that's just like Jackie.
Yeah. And an uncle that's just like Donald Trump. Maybe not.
Well, on that bombshell. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us.
I had heaps of fun. Thank you.
Salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Jeez, you did that well. You've been practicing. Did you practice that just for me?
No. I listen to a lot of rap music.
Yeah, me too. My pleasure.
And Ali Bombayo.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for this week. Thank you, Bill Shorten and Tanya Plibersek, for lending us one of your many, but few, emotive colleagues to talk to, and thank you, Dr. Ali, for joining us.
And coming up to the top of the hour, we have the News Bulletin with Bruce Hitchcock, followed by Hello Sport. And until next week, my name is Errol Parker, and you have a good one.
And I'm Clancy Overall. You be kind to each other.
Right now at Honda, find your kind of value. With a low finance rate offer on selected Civic hatch and sedan models, there's never been a better time to get into a Civic. So talk to your local dealer and let's help you into a Honda today. T's and C's apply. Ends August 31st. See website for details.